Commerce to order. Today we have two bills for public hearing only. The first one we're going to be hearing is SB 368. And Ms. Braun, why don't you give us an overview on 368?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 368 creates a tax credit for employing farm workers to offset increases in the minimum wage. We don't have a fiscal or revenue impact statement yet. And there is a subsequent referral to finance and revenue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Senator Schrader, I'm going to ask you to come forward. Is there anyone that you want to bring with you? Do you want the Farm Bureau?
Yeah, let's get Don Schoenberg if possible.
And then Mr. Dr. Martin, I guess. Excuse me. Apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Kurt Schrader, representing Senate District 20. I'll just give you some background and then turn it over to the certified smart people, if you will. Senate Bill 368 is a bit of a repeat of a bill that came out of this body last session, went over the House, and seemed to have trouble moving any further, but it did pass the Senate with a bipartisan vote. Background on this, actually, I think is pretty clear. This is an attempt by some of us to maintain the principle of minimum wage and indexed minimum wage and yet find a way to take care of an industry that unfortunately has a great deal of trouble taking care of itself with this particular indexing that we've got before us at this point in time. I would suggest to this committee that agriculture, unfortunately, like many, many, most other, perhaps every other industry in our great country, is at the mercy of international markets and actually other state markets that don't have the index minimum wage to where they cannot be competitive. I'm very concerned over the last 10 years. I think our party, I've been proud to be a part of some of the land use initiatives that we've participated in to make farming somewhat competitive, even as our Willamette Valley grows and other high-value farmland around this state. We're at a juncture now with Measure 37 and other issues facing us that all of a sudden that safety valve for our farming community is gone, is really gone. And I think many farmers now that ordinarily would not take a second look at Measure 37 or something like that are beginning to say, geez, it's just harder and harder for me to stay competitive, what with the environmental regulations, with the labor costs, and frankly now with some land disadvantages looking at us, staring us in the face. So Senate Bill 368 is an attempt to maintain the principle of index minimum wage. What we're trying to do here is see, is there an appropriate level of tax credits for some of the wage increases above minimum wage that would help farmers in this state stay competitive, be able to farm on some of the most fertile ground in our country that's threatened by development in our state. I don't personally have a... as you see, there's a blank spot in the bill here. We're trying not to dictate to this committee what the appropriate amount would be to put in there. We're asking this committee to pass on whether farmers matter, if I may say so, in this state and should have some opportunities. I would hope the Finance Committee would be putting numbers in this bill. The bill passed last session. We thought we knew what the fiscal impact was going to be. There was some confusion at the last minute, unfortunately, as it passed over to the House. And I think that's the reason the governor felt he could not sign that bill last session. He actually has commissioned or decommissioned a summer ago, at least originally a study or some money to do a study. That became problematic. And then to their credit, I think the Farm Bureau and others stepped forward and said, hey, you know, has our community, has our state, have the farm workers been hit by this indexed minimum wage bill in some way that maybe some of the original proponents of indexed minimum wage didn't anticipate? And so they went out, they spent their own money, they funded a study, and Dr. Martin and Mr. Schoenberg and others, I think, are here to give you some information on that so we can make good decisions moving forward, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you. And Senator Schrader, I know that you have a tight schedule. Did you want to stay for the panel, or do you need to leave?
If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to be excused. I apologize for that to the panel.
Is there any questions for Senator Schrader? If not, what I'm going to do is go ahead and excuse you, and then Representative Clem, if you want to come up and join the panel. And why don't we go ahead and I'm not sure what your schedule is. Do you want to be part of the panel in the sense of speaking right now, or do you?
Better check. I need to turn off my phone.
Yes, and that reminds me, it's a technical difficulty here. If you have a cell phone or electronic device, if you put it into the off position, it does in fact impact the reception in the recording of audio. And so if you have one, please turn it to the off position. And Representative, I'm not sure what you need, if you want to go first and then leave, or do you want to hear the panel's report and then testify?
I have one other hearing that I need to be in.
Why don't we go ahead, Representative, why don't you give us your testimony, and that way we'll move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Clem, State Representative for the Salem area. And I caught the last little bit of Senator Schrader's comments, so I won't have to duplicate a whole lot. I am supportive of this bill and certainly this concept. I'm somebody who has had a lot of experience in the last several years competing in an industry professionally from a family side where we compete with mostly foreign countries on hand-picked fruit, pears, cherries, apples. And there is a difficult time in competing with foreign countries because of the labor prices that we all have to face the exact same condition, which is you walk up and pick the fruit. And, you know, we don't use machines in these particular areas. And I think this is the approach that I prefer. I've had testimony and comments from Chambers of Commerce and other folks talking about, you know, they didn't feel the voters were correct in automatically indexing the minimum wage. I tend to disagree. I'm fine with that part. I just like many other issues, I think the voters might need to share in the cost of that if it is for an industry that is on the verge of going away, period. And I really feel that in certain sectors, there are some that are on the verge of extinction. You can look at the Measure 37 maps and see that people, you know, are at least potentially thinking out of getting out of the business and going into the real estate business. They're very clear occasionally that they don't intend to do it right now, but that they want an escape parachute because their industry they don't believe to be viable in the long term. And, you know, whether that's true or not is something that we won't know until it's too late. I do believe that this is an approach that the state of Oregon should take. If it's only to help provide a percentage because of available funds of the difference in between the minimum wage and our competitors, at least in surrounding states or nationally even, I think that would be acceptable as well. But, you know, I've felt in a very real way the pain of some of the folks in the Hood River Valley that's been in the Oregonian a number of times. And I do think that it is one area to assist growers with. There are others. This is not the only one. But it is one area to assist one of their costs of inputs. And, you know, we'd all love to have a much better market and a better price. And those are things that we've got some other legislation that you can help with if it gets to your floors. But for now, I appreciate you hearing this bill and having this discussion. And just want to support the concept and this bill in particular.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for the representative before he's excused? Representative Clem, thank you very much. Don, you and Dr. Martin, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourselves and give us the summary on your study.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Also appreciate Senator Schrader for introducing this piece of legislation, giving us at least a vehicle, if not maybe the exact measure of how this is going to happen. But we do appreciate that. Appreciate Representative Clem's interest in the bill as well. Senator Schrader mentioned a good part of what I was going to say as far as my introduction was concerned. I might back up a little bit and say that in the last legislative session when we did Senate Bill 1083A, which it came to be, as he indicated, there was a different interpretation of the bill on the Senate side as to what the fiscal impact would be when it passed the Senate last time. It went over to the House side, and there the fiscal was looked at again, looked at the language, understood what our intent was. And our intent was, as Senator Schrader indicated, was to mitigate the impacts of the indexing of the minimum wage. And as Representative Clem also mentioned, I think it's a unique way of doing it, and that in fact, as he mentioned, agriculture, as Senator Schrader mentioned, agriculture does not have the ability to pass on its increased costs. And so by reimbursing the agriculture community for agricultural labor, that in effect does pass that cost on to the general public, because money comes out of the general fund, which is funded by the general public and the income tax. And so in that regard, it does make perfect sense to do that. The bill was correctly understood over on the House side, went ahead and passed the House, as Senator Schrader indicated, and then was ultimately vetoed by the governor. The agriculture industry, as he said, did come forward then and decided that we did need some empirical evidence about what the impact was. We came to you last session with anecdotal evidence of what the impact was of indexing the minimum wage. And so we decided we needed to do that. We raised the funds to do that in the agriculture industry. And then after some extensive research, come across Dr. Martin, and he from the University of California at Davis, and contracted with him to do that study. Just a little bit about Dr. Martin. He studied labor economics and agricultural economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he earned his Ph.D. in 1975. He's a professor of agricultural resource economics at the University of California at Davis and chair of the University of California 60-member Comparative Immigration and Integration Program. Dr. Martin does research on farm labor and rural poverty, labor migration, and population issues. He has testified before Congress and state and local agencies numerous times on these issues. Dr. Martin has earned a reputation as an effective analyst who can develop practical solutions to complex and controversial migration and labor issues. So now we've got him, and we have a very complex one here. He was the only academic appointed to the Commission on Agricultural Workers to assess the effects of the Immigration Reform Control Act of 1986. You remember that as IRCA back in 1986. Other studies that he's conducted were evaluating the effects of foreign workers on Malaysia's economy in 1994 and 95, and examining the demographic and economic factors that sustain the Mexico-U.S. migration for the Binational Study of Migration 1996 and 97. He has now authored the study that you have in front of you. We're pleased to be able to give you a copy of that. And at this point, then, I would turn the microphone over to Dr. Martin and let him tell you about the study. And again, we appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Dr. Martin.
Thank you, Don, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss the impacts of minimum wage indexing on Oregon's agricultural industry. I'm Philip Martin, and I prepared this report at the request of the Oregon agricultural industry to examine the impacts of the index minimum wage on the state's farms and farm workers. As you know, Measure 25 was an initiative approved in November 2002 that raised Oregon's minimum wage from $6.50 to $6.90 an hour and then indexed that minimum wage to the consumer price index for urban areas, which has resulted in the minimum wage increasing by 3 to 4% a year. At $7.80 an hour in 2007, Oregon has the second highest minimum wage in the United States. The index minimum wage has had an especially serious impact on Oregon agriculture. An employer of about 35,000 farm workers on a year-round basis, or an average annual basis, and the keystone of the larger food and fiber sector that accounts for over 150,000 jobs in Oregon and contributes about 10% to the gross state product. Many of Oregon's farms are having difficulty absorbing the cost of a minimum wage that rises with the urban cost of living. The Oregon legislature recognized that difficulty in 2005 and when it approved SB 1083A, which would have provided a transferable tax credit for the wages paid to farm workers that reflected the difference between the state's current minimum wage and the non-indexed $6.90 an hour for 4 years between 2006 and 2009. In 2006, when the minimum wage was $7.50 an hour, the tax credit would have been 60 cents an hour. My testimony focuses on three items: the cost of a tax credit, the impacts of the index minimum wage in Oregon agriculture, and the impacts of the index minimum wage in Oregon farm workers and the Oregon economy. The first, and perhaps most important, issue is the cost. To determine the cost of a state tax credit, we need to know how many qualifying hours are worked in Oregon agriculture and how much indexing has increased the state's minimum wage. We used two methods to estimate hours worked in Oregon agriculture, and they generated very similar results. Under both methods, about 72.5 million hours were worked by hired farm workers in Oregon agriculture in 2006. Multiplying 72.5 million by 60 cent, the 60 cent an hour difference between 750 and 690 puts the cost of a state tax credit at 43.5 million in 2006. The cost rises in future years primarily with the higher minimum wage to an estimated 67 million in 2007 and a projected 108 million by 2009. Second topic, impacts of the indexing on Oregon agriculture. Oregon has 40,000 farms that sold crops and livestock worth almost $3.8 billion in 2005. Crops generated about 70% of the state's farm revenue, and nursery crops accounted for about 40% of crop sales. Most of the commodities produced in Oregon were consumed outside the state. Exports of farm commodities to other countries were almost $900 billion in 2005 and were about one-fourth of the state's farm sales. If we add together farm and processed commodities, about 80% of Oregon's ag-related products leave the state, with half going to foreign countries. Oregon agriculture is being reshaped by local, national, and global forces, including cost-price squeezes in some commodities that reflect cost of production rising faster than the prices farmers receive for the commodities that they produce. Higher wages and the closure of several fruit and vegetable processing plants has accelerated the shift away from some commodities that are labor-intensive, including strawberries. The index minimum wage has direct and indirect effects on Oregon farmers. Farm employers are required to raise the wages of minimum wage workers each January 1st, and most also raise the wages of higher-paid workers to avoid wage compression. If employers did not raise the wages for workers earning more than the minimum wage, the gap between lower and higher wage workers would narrow, which could reduce worker morale and speed exits from the farm workforce. What that means is that a farm's wage costs typically rise at least as much as the 3-4% annual increase in the minimum wage, which can adversely affect the competitiveness of Oregon commodities and the farmers who produce them. Minimum wages in other states that produce commodities in competition with Oregon are often the federal $5.15 an hour. Minimum wages in other countries that compete with Oregon commodities at home and abroad are lower still, such as the roughly 50 pesos a day in Mexico, or about $4.50 a day, or the roughly $200 a month in Colombia for 48-hour work weeks, or about a little under $5 a day in Thailand. Oregon farm employers are coping with the index minimum wage by eliminating or shrinking employer-paid worker benefits, such as free or low-cost housing and bonuses, or restricting benefits to year-round or long-season workers. Some farmers have eliminated farm jobs by reducing or ceasing production of certain crops or changing production methods to use less labor. As was said before, the index minimum wage has its greatest impacts on mid-sized producers, encouraging them to get larger or to get smaller. What about the impacts on the farm workers and the economy? Most of Oregon's labor-intensive agriculture is in the Willamette Valley, where many farm workers are settling in cities and towns. On the one hand, the higher minimum wage increases worker paychecks. However, if free or low-cost on-farm housing is reduced or eliminated as farmers cope with an index minimum wage, especially seasonal workers who previously lived on farms may wind up in nearby cities, incurring both housing and transportation charges. And those housing and transportation charges can reduce their take-home earnings, as it were, by up to a third. If that happens, the index minimum wage, which on the one hand raises hourly earnings, can wind up reducing net earnings after housing and transportation costs are taken into consideration. Similarly, if farmers stop producing marginal but profitable crops, such as strawberries or vegetables, because of the index minimum wage, workers can face a gap in a usual sequence of seasonal jobs, which lowers their annual earnings. So people earn more when they work, but they wind up getting less work and therefore lower earnings. In that way, the combination of higher living and transportation costs, as well as lower earnings due to more seasonal labor market gaps, could wind up having the opposite effect on farm worker welfare as was intended by the index minimum wage. As you know, the minimum wage has been controversial since it was introduced because it forces a choice between the competing goods of more jobs and higher wages. Economists agree that higher minimum wages reduce employment or job growth, but they acknowledge that it's been very hard to measure the employment effects of a higher minimum wage in a dynamic and growing economy. Economists also agree that a more efficient way to raise the income of poor workers is via an earned income tax credit, because that expands both the number of jobs for and the earnings of low-wage workers. Most of the farm workers employed in Oregon agriculture are immigrants, and many are not authorized to work in the United States. Congress is considering immigration reforms that could affect especially the farm labor market. Under the major proposal called Ag Jobs, some unauthorized farm workers could earn a legal immigrant status by continuing to do farm work. And the current temporary worker program known as H-2A would be modified to make it easier for farm employers to hire legal guest workers. State minimum wages could affect access to guest workers, since farm employers are required to pay the higher of the federal or state minimum wage, the prevailing wage, or a special federal adverse effect wage rate. One part of Ag Jobs would freeze this so-called AWER at 2002 levels and study it, and the index minimum wage, therefore, could wind up being the effective wage for Oregon farmers seeking legal guest workers, slowing that transition to a legal workforce, which Ag Jobs is intended to accomplish. To conclude, Oregon has the second highest minimum wage in the United States in 2007 and has had relatively slow employment growth in recent years, especially in the private sector. Without employment growth in healthcare and construction, there would have been no private sector job growth in Oregon between 2000 and 2005. Agriculture provides about 35,000 year-round equivalent jobs for hired workers, which is three times the employment in the state's gas stations. And agriculture generates a significant number of jobs in both upstream and downstream industries that supply inputs to farmers and transport and process the commodities they produce. If the agricultural sector does not receive relief from the index minimum wage, the cost price squeeze that is already shrinking the number of mid-sized farmers and the production of labor-intensive crops is likely to accelerate. And farm workers may find the benefit of higher hourly wages offset by the reduced availability of jobs, housing, and other benefits. There is no doubt that a state tax credit will strengthen the finances of one of Oregon's leading industries. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Martin. Senator Morello, I was going to ask you, did you have any questions or do you need to take off?
No, I'm just okay. A pretty sick dog.
Senator Morello is being excused. As you can tell, we have what we call the capital crud. We had phase one last week, and it looks like it's still around this week. So for a benefit for Senator Morello, for us here at the dais, and for you out there, we're going to let him leave now. So I'm going to open up the panel for our questions. Starting with, we'll go this way, Avakian.
And I stepped out, so if you covered this, I apologize and don't cover it again, but has anybody defined the term attributable to in the bill? And the bill says that this applies to wages that are attributable to increases in the minimum wage, and I don't know what that language is. Let me help you by being a little more specific. If somebody is earning a wage that is, say, $9 an hour, clearly above the minimum wage, but the minimum wage indexes up, so the employer then says, well, I'm going to then index up the $9 so it stays relative to what the increase in minimum wage, is that covered by the attributable to language and therefore the bill applies?
Chairman Puzonski and Senator Avakian, I don't believe that aspect of it is covered in that manner. Now, the intent is that all wages, the wages of all agriculture employers, at least in Senate Bill 1083. Now, this bill may not be that way. In 1083, it applied to all wages. But it applied only the indexed amount. It didn't make any difference how much you were earning up and down the line. It simply said there is an indexed minimum wage, and this is the effect of that, and that's what we're going to compensate you for. Now, in this Senate Bill 368 here, it leaves a blank space there, as Senator Schrader talked about, and that would be an amount. I believe, as I read the bill, I believe it applies to minimum wage or workers and any worker who earns minimum wage plus X, and that X and that blank is left blank there to fill in later. The issue that we're dealing there really is trying to, I think what he's trying to deal with is the compression issue, so that when you increase the wage of the minimum wage worker and that ripples on up, how high does that have to ripple before there's really not much effect? And that's the reason for identifying that particular blank piece right there.
Any follow-ups? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked in your summary, you mentioned other countries and how we're competing with them. But I guess I'm curious to know how you rate the economy or Oregon's ag economy versus our neighboring states and the impact on our economies as a whole, specifically California, Washington.
Well, thank you. I think Oregon, agriculture and natural resources are a bigger share of the state's economy than they are in California and Washington. If we take the California agricultural economy, for example, we have farm sales of around $32 billion a year, and farm and farm-related employment of a little less than $1 million a year. But we have a state gross state product of in the order of about $1.6 trillion a year, and we have about a labor force of about 17 million. So Oregon, as opposed to California, the agricultural sector is smaller, but it's relatively bigger relative to the state economy. And the same is true in Washington. There's a relatively bigger manufacturing services sector, so that while agriculture may have larger farm sales, it doesn't play as big an important role in the economy. The second thing to keep in mind that makes the Oregon agricultural sector unique is that many of the commodities produced in the state are sent out of the state. So in the nursery district, for example, California's nursery industry is larger than Oregon's nursery industry. But most of what's produced in the California nursery industry, much of it stays within the state because we're a fast-growing state and the nursery products are being put into housing. In Oregon, by contrast, most of what the vast majority of what's produced is sent out of state. So Oregon is in a position of where cost conditions within the state affect its ability to produce and send to other places, whereas in California it's much more, as it were, maintained within the state. So I guess my summary would be, in Oregon, the agricultural sector is relatively more important to the state economy, and it's very important as a keystone to link back to input industries and to link forward to processing and distribution industries.
Thank you. And I got a couple of questions. So first, I guess, Don, when this bill was before us 2 years ago, if I'm memory serves me correctly, there are some interpretations that were done on the Senate side as to what we thought it was going to cost. When it got over to the House, for whatever reason, there was an expansion as to the, how many people would actually be covered under that. Is that a fair memory that I have? Is that?
Yes, Chair Brzezinski, that is a fair statement. On the Senate side, the interpretation was that it applied only to minimum wage workers, and that the minimum that the tax credit was only that amount from one year to the next, not the accumulated amount. And so there was a significant difference in the fiscal impact when that bill moved over to the House side, and the bill was, in our opinion, correctly interpreted when it got over there.
All right. So under that being correctly interpreted on the House side versus incorrectly on this side, how's the bill, Senate Bill 368, worded? Is it the exact same wording as 1083, where it would have that broader interpretation?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the bill as drafted, again, it has that provision where it applies only to those receiving minimum wage up to minimum wage and an amount up to X. what that figure is, hasn't been decided. Okay. So in that regard, it's a little bit different, but it is more limiting than what the version was that we had in here 2 years ago.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Dr. Martin, please don't take these personal. I just need to get a grasp on different things. Has this paper study that you've done had any peer review, or does it go through any type of process for that? Or is this, because it's in the contract, it's just basically you back to the Farm Bureau?
I had other people look at it, but it has not undergone formal peer review, no.
All right. And in prior studies, have you done this type of analysis before for other groups or situations?
This is the first time I've done one in Oregon. I've done many studies for the U.S. government and for other governmental agencies.
Similar type of constructs?
I analyzed the wage rate, for example, that's used to govern the H-2A program for the U.S. Department of Labor, to give one example, but I've done many of these.
Okay, great. The last question I have is, based on this report that you've provided, I just wrote down the question, where do we go from here? And I guess what I mean by that is that if this was implemented, would this take care of the issue? Or is what's next? Or is this something that we have to continue to look at, increasing such as the tax credit to maintain the competitive edge that we may be losing?
Well, it's always hard to predict the future, but what has happened is that you have an industry in the state of Oregon which has a natural comparative advantage. You have a natural resource-based industry, you've got a climate and other factors that give agriculture here some advantages which are not present in other states. The index minimum wage occurred at a time when at least one particular subsector of the state's agriculture was doing very, very well. That's the state's nursery industry. That was driven in part by extraordinarily low interest rates nationally and a very rapid pace of housing construction nationally. And since so much of Oregon's nursery industry, for example, is sent out of the state, that the industry in that case could still continue growing, even though costs were going up quite high. It's not as if this was no impact, but in some ways the rapid growth due to that housing boom could allow you to have the rising minimum wage and, for example, increased sales, increased hours. What will happen now is most likely there will be a slowdown in housing. We don't yet know how fast that will come. With the boom in housing and with the cost difference between Oregon and states in the Middle South, say Tennessee, places like that, competitive industries developed there. If the housing industry slows down, there will be a shakeout in the nursery industry. The question is going to be where it shakes out. The state tax credit alone, no one can say with the state tax credit alone, everything will be great for the Oregon industry. Without the state tax credit, it's going to be much tougher for the Oregon industry, because with more nurseries, for example, coming online, selling into a market that's shrinking, somebody's going to have to get shaken out. And that's the kind of issue which will have to get, you know, if you're trying to strengthen the financial capacities of Oregon agriculture, one way to do that is to give a state tax credit for the index and part of the minimum wage.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and I apologize that I was unable to be here at the beginning of your testimony, sir. But I do have a couple of questions. I'm looking at page 2 of your written testimony and the third paragraph under the heading Impacts on Oregon Agriculture. And in that last sentence in that third paragraph, you state that if employers did not raise wages for above minimum wage workers, the gap between lower and higher wage workers would narrow, which could reduce worker morale and speed exits from farm work. That, from where I sit, that reads like an assumption. And so could you tell us, on what evidence are you basing that statement?
We did, as part of this study, talk to somewhere between 15 and 20 Oregon growers. But so this is not a survey of Oregon growers and how they have in general adapted. But I can say, as a labor economist, most employers have wage scales. And in agriculture, the minimum wage is normally the entry-level wage. But in an agricultural operation with 200 employees, there might be 15 to 30% at the minimum wage and other people at 25 cents more, 50 cents more, whatever, some increment above that. If the minimum wage goes up by 30 cents and workers above that do not get their wages raised as well, then that's the so-called wage compression effect. The bottom comes up, the top doesn't go up, and the wage bands get compressed. That's why most employers wind up raising wages when they raise them because of the index minimum wages at the bottom. They also raise them up the scale. And everyone we talked to said that's what they do. That's also what the literature in labor economics says, that you do your best to avoid wage compression. What I'm saying is, if people, and why do they do that? If they did not do that, one consequence could be reduced worker morale or speed exits. We did not find people who did not raise the higher level wages. The people we talked to raised them up the scale.
And so, if I may follow up, you talked with 15 to 20 growers?
Right, correct.
Somewhere in that range. And how many growers are there in Oregon?
Well, there's 40,000 farms, but probably most of the employment is concentrated on 1,500, 2,000 of the farms.
How did you select the 15 to 20?
We were looking. We took people who were in. We basically looked at crop sales. So we talked to people in nurseries, because nurseries is 40%. We talked to people in strawberries and flowers, tree fruits. I mean, we tried to get some representative cases from the various commodities.
And last question, if I may. Why is this good public policy?
Well, the main argument for indexing the minimum wage, or giving a tax credit for indexing the minimum wage, is if indexing the minimum wage is good public policy to raise the wages automatically of the lowest wage workers, if we have an industry which has a comparative or competitive advantage here in Oregon, but which is shipping its products to other states and countries that don't have index minimum wages, if we don't offset that automatic cost, those industries are going to be in competitive pressure. So if we're trying to preserve the index minimum wage that raises the hourly earnings of the workers, it makes public policy sense to also protect the industry in which they're employed, or you lose the jobs there. And since there's no requirement that farmers grow certain crops or provide certain benefits, you can have perhaps the unintended effect of having farmers make adjustments to the higher costs associated with index minimum wages, which wind up not benefiting the workers as the intent of the indexing was meant to do.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank
Our
you.
Next panel is going to be Duke Shepherd and Stephen Witte. Shepherd, when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We are here in opposition to Senate Bill 368, which we find is substantially the same as Senate Bill 1083A, and it sounded from the previous panel that it is indeed, we're correct in our assessment of it as being substantially the same. Let me say that we do value farmers. We value all businesses in Oregon. Those are the ones that provide the jobs that our members work at. While we don't have a cost impact for this particular bill, we do know that the same definitions for eligibility were used in 1083, and the impact on the state treasury was established at over $137.8 million for a four-year period in 05, and there were some compelling numbers I felt produced by the Farm Bureau just moments ago over the cost by 2009. But beyond the fiscal impact, we would question the use of any tax breaks to reward recipients for complying with the law. The minimum wage is a voter-approved law of the land. And that's what we see this bill's intent. Second, we would question the use of tax breaks to provide subsidies to employer without regard to circumstance. Right now, the case that's been made has been the economic hardship caused by both minimum wage and an out-of-state and foreign competition in labor-intensive aspects of their businesses. But this doesn't limit its tax breaks to employers who just face hardships. It's those who face increased costs. So that's profitable, unprofitable, high margin, low margin. Third, there are always unintended consequences when tax breaks designed for special circumstances are applied across the board to large categories of taxpayers. And finally, in 2005, the AFL-CIO suggested that a better vehicle would be a fixed allocation of funds to the Agriculture Department to provide subsidies to mitigate extreme economic hardships that would save jobs and would otherwise be lost to foreign competition. It seems to us this would prevent the escalation of costs that's created by the bill as constructed both in 05 and currently. And finally, I would say, and I hope it's all right, I've skipped through. I didn't want to just read word for word my testimony.
You're doing great.
It seems to me that the testimony you've heard thus far is increased costs are caused by minimum wage and. There's always another, there's an and, whether it's foreign competition, fuel costs. So there's no doubt that farmers are in distress, that there are many low-margin businesses that are in distress in Oregon for a variety of factors. It seems to me that the case so far has been one of failed trade policies by the United States, more so than a minimum wage increase in Oregon, which is frankly the least volatile of all the cost drivers you've heard. It's predictable. It's CPI. You know it's coming. You can see it. You can adjust your operations around it. The other cost drivers are not predictable, particularly the foreign trade aspects. Those are going to continue to spiral and to drive hardship for workers across the economy in a variety of industries. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Witte.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Witte. I'm the new Pacific Northwest Director for the United Farm Workers. And obviously it's in the interests of our members that we have a strong and vital agricultural sector in the state of Oregon. I just question, with all the ifs and the lack of information, if this is the best vehicle to maintain that. First and foremost, I believe that the Senate Bill 368, as it is currently as we currently have it, could have long-term detrimental effects on the lives of agricultural workers and their families, as well as agriculture itself in the state of Oregon. I believe this bill would encourage agriculture employers not to provide or give financial incentives for work skill improvements or increased productivity. This has the possibility of being detrimental to the segment of Oregon's population who provides from their families from the wages received from employment in Oregon's agricultural sector. I believe this bill would further weaken the financial security of our farm worker population. Implementation of this proposal would only encourage workers to exit working in the ag sector of our economy. It is ironic that this bill comes at a time when just last season we experienced shortages of available labor in the state. We believe that with fewer and fewer incentives to remain available for agricultural employment, SB 368 would undermine Oregon's agricultural economy. And I think, secondly, there's no compelling reason to offer a tax credit to employers for merely obeying the law. I think what is really being said is, you know, we're giving you this tax credit for that purpose. And with this line of logic, then why shouldn't I be entitled to a tax credit for using the cruise control of my auto when I drive to Salem to assure that I not exceed the posted speed limit law? What would prevent other employers traditionally known for keeping their employees at minimum wage for asking for the same or a similar tax credit? I believe that the state's financial situation is such that we have, is the state's financial situation is such that we have ample funds to give away. I believe as it currently stands, SB 368 is based on such a flawed premise. Lastly, I think that there are indications going in that the governor could possibly veto this bill. And we believe that with a short-sighted tax credit, this would undermine the ag sector of the economy and be unfairly directed towards the workers that the United Farm Workers represents and the immigrant community. As it currently stands, the United Farm Workers urges that SB 368 not be passed out of committee.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Not seeing any. Thank you, gentlemen. And I have three other people that are scheduled to testify, at least that are signed up: Michael Dell, Ramon Ramirez, and Jody Weiser. Was there anyone else in the room that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 368? If not, okay, what I'm going to do is let's go ahead and have Michael Dell and Ramon come on up. And I'm going to call you up next, sir. I got one more person. Jody, why don't you come on up now and fill out this panel, and then we'll do yours after that. And if you're providing us with written testimony, I'm going to ask you not to read from the testimony, just summarize so we can stay on time. We've got another bill to hear before we close today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Workers Justice Project, a private nonprofit law firm that represents low-wage workers. I come to this issue, though, with 25 years' experience as a migrant legal services attorney and the former director of the statewide migrant program. I appear before you to oppose this bill, primarily for three reasons. The first is it's unworkable. The problem is the one that perhaps Senator Avakian was getting at, in that how does one know what part of which wage increase is attributable to the increase in the minimum wage? Let me give you just one example. Suppose there are some workers who are 25 cents above minimum wage, and the employer doesn't raise their wages when the wages goes up, and so they wind up being at minimum wage. And they're disgruntled, and they go on strike. And they strike for higher wages. And as a result of the settlement of the strike, the employer concedes a wage increase. Is that increase attributable to the minimum wage? If it's not, what does this term mean? If it is, then what wage increase above minimum wage is not attributable? And so for that reason, it's entirely unworkable. The bill kicks that over to rulemaking, and perhaps that's done because of the perplexity of the issue, but I'm here to suggest that agency rulemaking is going to be no more prescient on this issue than this committee could be, and that, in fact, it's going to be very difficult to define that term. Secondly, I think it's bad policy to establish a precedent that when the state's voters, in their wisdom, decide to improve wages and working conditions, that employers must be compensated for that advantage. I think that's going to come back and bite the legislature. I can assure you that there are other low-wage industries who are also in economic stress, who are going to be right here on the heels of agriculture, also asking for a tax break. And then the next time there's any effort at all to improve wages or working conditions of workers, won't you then also have to pay for that as well? And the point is, there are certain minimum conditions. We're not talking about a lot. We're talking about minimum livable conditions that to participate in this economy, the public policy of the state says you have to meet. And I just think it's a bad precedent to get into the idea of tit for tat paying employers to comply with those things. Now, having said that, I would say as an aside that basically what this is a tax subsidy for agriculture, and the minimum wage is used as a way to appeal for that. And in all honesty, ag in Oregon is facing a real crisis at this point because of the vicissitudes of international trade and the changing markets and the way that we treat processing and all kinds of things are causing some real dislocations in particular segments of the market. And if we had a targeted tax break that took that into account, or a targeted subsidy that tried to help people make that transition in a way that seemed like it would help people get over the hump and that you'd have a sustainable industry, I might be able to support it. But the problem is tying it to this particular phenomenon of the wage increase. And that's particularly true because the third reason I oppose it, and that is that it seems to me the structure of this, that whatever level you set the subsidy at, the subsidy trigger, that becomes essentially not a wage floor anymore, that becomes a wage ceiling. Because to move wages above that level, workers are going to have to not only overcome the increased costs that will cause, but also the loss of subsidy. And essentially what we're doing it would be subsidizing people to keep pay at or near the minimum wage, and that's not really in the interests of agriculture. I'd like to comment on a couple of things that Professor Martin raised. And by the way, you have before you one of the preeminent national experts on this stuff. I know his work and have been familiar with it for years, and this is a real McCoy. He's a smart guy who has a lot of perception. If one views the body of his work, however, one of the things that I was surprised I didn't hear about is increasing productivity. One of the things that Professor Barton has written about significantly is that rising wages can be dealt with in a number of different ways, but one of the things it does is it creates an incentive for making investments that create productivities that then allow the employer to pay a higher wage. And it seems to me that's a part of this piece that we didn't hear about today. There was also reference to the impending passage of ag jobs. I would point out that if ag jobs is adopted, then in agriculture, for workers who are from another country, the minimum wage will become the AWER that was referred to, the special minimum wage that is established by the Department of Labor. And basically what it is the average wage in the region that farm workers made in the region in the prior year. So instead of having the entry-level wage be the minimum wage and you work your way up to the average wage, if you're talking about foreign workers, the wage that has to be paid is the average wage, and if you are hiring foreign workers, you also have to hire U.S. workers at the same wages and working conditions. So that in itself will cause a substantial increase in the national agricultural wage rate, and not just here in Oregon, or perhaps not at all in Oregon, because it may well be true that our minimum wage is as high as the AWER. But that will also cause a rise in wage rates across the country, even in places that we're competing. And the other thing that I think we need to take into consideration is that ag jobs isn't the only thing that's pending, and one might say that the increase in the national minimum wage might well be more likely than passage of immigration reform, and that also will have the effect of leveling the playing field so that the competition that we're talking about will not not be as stark as it may perhaps be on the day we meet here today. So for all of these reasons, we think it's bad policy. We're not unsympathetic to the question of some segments of the agricultural industry needing some help. If we could have a bill that was targeted narrowly to that, was addressed to where the problems are, and that was addressed to getting us past that hump, we might be supported, but we can't support this bill as it stands and urge that it not be passed out onto the floor. And actually, there was one other thing I wanted to say quickly, and that was the question of the loss of the value of on-farm housing. I've represented farm workers for 25 years. The trade, on-farm housing is a funny kind of a deal. Much of the on-farm housing, particularly in recent years, does not permit family occupancy, does not permit year-round...
I'm going to ask you to kind of summarize on this because you're getting into a little bit different area, and I've got at least four more witnesses on this bill alone.
Okay. Thank you. I'll do that quickly. My point is simply that the trade of a higher wage for lost seasonal labor camp housing is not necessarily a bad trade from a farm worker's perspective. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Ramirez.
Yes, Chair Prozanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of the Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN. And on behalf of our 5,000 members plus, we want to strongly oppose Senate Bill 368. I want to... I submitted testimony, so it's written testimony. But in your packet, I included the 2007 adverse effect wage rate for the country, which is on this document here. So it gives you an idea of what the wage rate for guest workers are coming into the country. And the reason why I wanted to highlight this in my presentation was because I think Oregon agriculture is feeling the pressure of foreign competition, but I also think that that there's other factors that are involved. For example, I think in terms of Oregon agriculture, one of the niche markets that I think the some of our industries have, like in nurseries, which was pointed out in Phil Martin's presentation, which I also want to acknowledge that I'm a good friend of Phil Martin's. We worked together for many years on agricultural worker issues for many years, and so I want to acknowledge that. He is a friend of ours. But I want to go back to the factor of Oregon agriculture. I think one of the things why, if we look at the nursery industries, why it's a niche market is that I think one of the factors is climate that, really influences, our competition. For many years, I think we've seen a rise in gate sales in nurseries. And I think we'll continue to see that. I don't think, the housing boom, in this country is going to dictate that, whether it goes or whether it fluctuated. Maybe a little bit. But I think it's more like climate. You know, we surpassed Florida in gate sales, a few years ago. And the reason why, and not only Florida, but Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, is that we have a niche market. We grow a crop, a seedling that can grow, and continue to grow in the Northeast, which if you look at the, if you look at where our products are sold, they are sold in those markets where they could sustain a Chicago winter or a Vermont winter. So a lot of our crops are headed that way. When they go out of state, we're producing a product that is sustainable and that people like our products because they're durable and they last, right? The city of Chicago buys a lot of our products. They stop buying it from North Carolina because North Carolina seedlings cannot withstand a Chicago winter. And that are some of the things that I would say that in the study is not reflective. You know, we produce a niche market. I think if we're going to continue to make Oregon agriculture sustainable, marketable, and do the right thing, I think then we have to look at this whole issue of the of wages. Because one of the things that's happening is that, among others, is that wages plays an important role of whether a farm worker comes here or not, right? And if we're going to be one of those states where I think Michael Dale is right, is in terms of wages, if we're paying near or merely just minimum wage, we're going to chase away our workforce. We're already having a hard time on the immigration issue here in this state. I mean, we'll end up like Colorado, where farm workers don't even want to go to Colorado anymore because not only is farm labor hard, backbreaking work, but they're not even being afforded the dignity of, you know, because they're, you know, farm workers do us a favor. They're the ones that put food on the table. And we got to work together with the farmers, and we got to create a partnership. But I think that partnership is based on respect. And so one of the things that we got to do is really, when we look at wages, you know, we really should be increasing wages, not looking at it from the other perspective. And I think there's some other stuff that we could do. I mean, we'd be willing to, as a farm worker union, along with the United Farm Workers of America, to sit down with Ag, with the Farm Bureau and others, to think of creative ways that we could come up with to how do we make Oregon agriculture sustainable and marketable so that in the long run, it really, for us, it's really important that Oregon agriculture sustains itself because that's where we earn our salaries. So I just wanna end by saying that please look at the adverse wage rate. I think it's really telling when you see that when we talk about foreign competition for states like North Carolina and Florida and stuff, where their minimum wage for foreign workers is $9.55 or $9.02 an hour. So we're talking about, you know, a minimum wage rate much more higher than the 780 we have here in the state of Oregon. I have other information in my packet, so if you have any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions? Oh, I forgot. Jody?
Senator Bukusansky and committee, my name is Jody Weiser for the record. I'm here as one of those taxpayers that voted for the minimum wage increase and supported that campaign. And I also come from a farm background, recently sold a farm. There's no doubt that the farm industry is important to this state. It, as we've heard today, is 10% of the economy. But there's also no doubt that we already pay good attention to this industry. If you look at an area like Woodburn, you'll see reduced property taxes for the farms there and a very expensive school funding formula to support the second language and low-income population that works on the farms, subsidized housing, Head Start programs, health care clinics, child care subsidies, and earned income tax credits. Clearly, $7.80 an hour is a problem. But mechanization may be a good part of the solution. When I was a child, our cotton was picked by people, not machines, and it was planted by people, not machines. That has changed over time, and every industry has seen those kind of changes. When we're supporting jobs at $7.80 an hour, we're still providing other support besides a tax credit we might give to the farmer. And so it's not really sustainable for us to continue doing that. A tax credit for farmers who participate in the world market, whose employees already need public services, is this really the solution to the problem? And how will we judge if the goals are being met? Dr. Martin's testimony was sprinkled with words like could, may, should, might. There's no certainty in a lot of the different characteristics. You know, the best years in farming on our farm was when there was bad weather someplace else. That's when we made big money. And there's so many things that go into the formula of being a successful farmer. The wages simply are not the deciding factor. This bill provides subsidy to every farmer with a farm worker, which means it provides the same subsidy to a wildly successful winery selling wine for $50 a bottle, or to a farmer who's barely making it through with having changed their cropping patterns, tried doing value-added ideas, and changing their crop mix. It provides the same benefit to farmers who can raise their prices and to farmers who can't. In what other ways do we spend public dollars as indiscriminately as this legislation proposes? If farms in Oregon can't stay in business without subsidy of their employees' wages, there's something wrong with their business model, not something wrong with our minimum wage. These tax credits will either subsidize farmers' profitability or the prices of their products. The crop mix in Oregon means we could be subsidizing the price of grass seed in China, or blueberries in Japan, or Christmas trees in Arizona. Are those prices our highest priority as a state? Because our responsibility in this room is to look after the whole state. A key argument in favor of the bill is that our high wages make our ag products non-competitive. But soon the new federal minimum wage will address that issue. It's not fair to ask school children to share large classes to subsidize farms, whether they're well managed and profitable or not.
Wiser, I'm going to get you to close it down because I've got more witnesses, more bills.
There are some technical issues with the bill that I've handed you a paper about. The way it's written, I think a lawyer could look at it, and in a court they could have us subsidizing everything from $5.50 up. I think that would need to be clarified. There's some clear wording in the companion bill by Schrader, 2531, that clearly says start at $7.80 and go to $11 per hour. And that makes it really clear what you're subsidizing, and I think that you need clarity in this bill, not lack of clarity. The bill is written as a four-year bill.
Ms. Weiser, I'm going to go ahead and cut you off. You're reading from your testimony now. So I'm going to go ahead and open up the panel. For any questions, thank you for this. This will go through that. We just don't have enough time. I've got more people need to get up here before we get down today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the gentleman who raised his hand, I think he wanted to come up.
It's nice to meet you too, sir.
It's more important for you to get your testimony than shaking our hand. You can always do that afterwards. But thank you anyway.
Well, again, Mike Townsend from Townsend Farms, and I appreciate Senator and Senator Gordley, Senator Przanski, Anna Braun, Roger Beyer, and I hope I say this correctly, Avakanian.
I was going to make you try since you almost got the handshake up here. It's Avakian.
I'm sorry,
Avakian. It's all right.
Okay.
It's a good try.
Okay, what I would like to say from the beginning is I really respect everybody else's testimony today. And what I want to do is just give you a little idea of reality, what it's like to be a grower processor in Oregon. I'm a member of Farm Bureau. I'm also a member of Northwest Food Processors organization, which has been around for over 70 years. First of all, I want to indicate that we're a grower processor. We have a plant in Fairview, Oregon, and in Woodburn. We farm over 1,200 acres, and we also buy from over probably another 200 growers. So we're not just a grower, and we're not just a processor. We're kind of doing about four different things. We also have a cold storage facility. We also market all of our own products directly to people like Kroger, Safeway.
Mr. Townsend, can you just back off the microphone just a little bit?
There
you
go. How's that?
That's wonderful.
I don't hear very well. I don't have hearing aids.
Okay.
So we're kind of a very diverse business. We also, besides doing frozen, we have a fresh market business. And those customers are people like Kroger, Sam's Club, Costco, Safeway, Albertsons. So both entities, both the frozen entity and the fresh entity, sell to those type of people within the industry. I would like to add that we also have seasonal housing.
Why don't you give us your testimony about the bill?
Okay.
On 368.
Okay. In regards to the testimony, in regards to the bill, I'd like to say that every year the impact on our company is $285,000 every year the minimum wage goes up, the CPI portion of the minimum wage. And all I can say simply is, you know, you come and hold my hand when I have to go in front of people that I'm selling product to, which I'm competing with people in different states, different processing plants, and every year I have an increase of $230,000. I have to go to that billion-dollar company and ask for more money because of the fact that I have to raise a wage. I would say that there's been less competition in our industry because of we've lost a lot of people in our industry, in the frozen fruit industry and the vegetable industry. But still, we have a thriving economy here in Oregon. We have great weather. We have great water. And we've had a good amount of labor. But now that labor is shrinking, and that's a broader issue than this 368 and being able to get some help in regards to being competitive within the marketplace. I think that's a simple statement. I think that, you know, what we're trying to do as a community and as in terms of business and the people that I work with is we want to know what are we going to do long term here when wages are $9 and $10 an hour. How do you invest in your business long term, people? You're asking me, we have a $14 million payroll at our company. And when you're asking me to go out, and I'm maybe kind of an industry leader, you know, for me to go out and invest in my business, I don't have a sustainable minimum wage that I think will let me pay off that long-term investment. So I hope you understand, and I know you're in a hurry, but I hope you understand when you put people in that position, it negates long-term investment in this state. And I think some of the issues that have brought out about where we're going as an industry, I think people need to come forward and be visionaries and not just trying to come up with issues that are just going to be quick fixes. Does that make sense? I think the industry is asking for some help in terms of where it's at to be competitive. And I'd like to make sure you guys have time for questions, and I would really like a couple questions.
Well, we'll see if there's any questions. Any questions? Sorry, we don't have any questions.
Thank you very much. Nelson,
thank you very much for your time and your testimony. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 368. And at this point, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to take up the offer that Mr. Ramirez had said, and for Mr. Schellenberg, I'd like for y'all to get together and talk. It seems like y'all should have been talking since last session as to what, if anything, can be done as to whether we want to make any look at 368 in a different light than what it's being presented today. And it may not even fit under the relating clause, but if y'all want to talk, that would be great. So with that, we have closed the public hearing on Senate Bill 368. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 556. And I have, looks like, three people that are listed here to give testimony today, and it is Lane Barlow, Michael Wood, and Bill, I'm not going to even try your last name. Gostofsky. I should know that. Yeah, and before y'all give your testimony, very quickly, we're going to hear an overview from Ms. Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 556 increases the number of days for an employer to contest an occupational safety violation or an employee to contest the time to fix a violation from 20 days to 60 days, increases the number of days to record a final judgment as a lien on a property if the penalty is not paid from 10 days to 180 days. There's no revenue impact. It may have a fiscal impact. There's two amendments I could talk about, but
well,
I don't need to.
Yeah, we'll hold off on those for now. This is public hearing. What I'm going to ask you to do is, if you had written testimony, to just summarize from that. We got 7 minutes because other commitments. So, Lane, did you want to start off?
Yes. Thank you, Beth. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lane Barlow for Russian American Builders Association. To give everybody a chance here, summarize. We represent mostly small construction contractors, mostly in northern Marion County. Most of them don't even have office staff. This is about how penalties are paid and collected. This is not about safe workplaces. Our testimony speaks for itself as long as that's considered. I'll make a couple of quick points here. Our president, for instance, is facing a $27,000 fine when nobody was hurt. But yet, when you look at, if you go to the top of page 2, the December 14th Oregonian showed one company where a worker's, both his arms were ripped off near the elbow. The fine was $2,200, and another worker was crushed to death. The fine was $2,500. And in a care home in Lake Oswego, an elderly resident died of thirst due to lack of care. Fine was $975. We're asking two things. This bill is basically doing two things. First is we're extending the deadline. It's mostly for the convenience of the citizen contractors. And this is as it should be. Once a citation is validated, then it should be the rest of it is collection. The second is there's a problem with the current statute, and you see that in the middle of page under second. The statute that currently read violates separate powers. You have a judgment. If the penalty is not paid within 10 days after the order becomes final, we're looking to have that increased. Constitutes a judgment. Judgments come from courts, and this puts it on equal footing with somebody that's had a full jury trial, all the evidence considered, and so forth and so forth. And that is forbidden by our state constitution's separate powers prohibition. Why this is an emergency? There's fines that are ruining people, putting them out of business now. We'll spare you the testimony on that, and we reserve the right to rebuttal. Let's leave it at that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barlow. Bill?
Hi, for the record, my name is Bill Gostewski. I've been a contractor for about 12 years in Oregon. And my feelings are OSHA's got two agendas, which is to make money and stay alive and keep Oregon employers safe. Those are mine, too. The difference is they're the cat and I'm the mouse. And, I don't have a big office staff. I open my mail up once a month, pay my bills, and 20 days is not enough time for me to open my mail. So, and you know, that would be a big problem for me. Now I've worked with OSHA. You know, I've had my problems. I've paid my bills, and you know, everybody gets on their way. So, you know, we build your houses, we fix your roofs. Just feel a little bit of sympathy for us, and you know, give us a chance. We'll pay our bills, but give some time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Gentlemen, there are a couple of amendments that are floating around. If you haven't seen them, you should get hold of them and look at them. And thank you again for coming forward. Thank you for your brevity.
If I may, Mr. Chair, we're cool with the dash two amendments.
Okay.
Only the dash ones are contested.
Okay, so the dash twos you're fine with. And, Bill, you're okay with that, too?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wood?
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Wood. I am the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, what we refer to as Oregon OSHA. You have my written testimony in front of you. I will note only that it is, for us, all about promoting safety in the workplace. The penalties and the ability to appeal, the ability then to collect the penalties, are an integral part of that. The bill, as it's originally proposed, creates some concern with us. It would put us considerably out of step with other states, as well as with similar provisions of other Oregon laws. I will say for the record that we have looked at the Dash 2 amendments, and we are comfortable with those amendments and would be comfortable with the bill if those amendments were adopted.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 556? If not, thank you very much for everyone being here today. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 556. And Ms. Braun, anything else we need to do today?
No, we don't.
And the committee's adjourned. Thank you.